From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the revival of a performance and a film. Anne DeVere Smith's one-person show about the aftermath of the Los Angeles riots is about to open in New York. We'll hear an interview and performance recorded after the show premiered last year. There's a 25th anniversary re-release of the film Midnight Cowboy. We'll feature a 1988 interview with its director, John Schlesinger, who also directed Marathon Man, Sunday Bloody Sunday, and The Falcon and the Snowman. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new comedy, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal jury has found all four defendants in the World Trade Center bombing trial guilty on all counts. The verdict was reached after 5.5 days of deliberation. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports from outside the courthouse in New York.
As the verdicts were read, the four defendants sat motionless, but immediately afterward, defendant Nidal Ayad and defendant Mohammed Salama began shouting at the jury in English and Arabic. Salama was heard to say injustice and victim. After they were led from the courtroom, a man identified as Ayad's brother shouted, "My brother is innocent," from the back of the courtroom. He's been cited for contempt of court. The judge said he believed the outburst by the defendants had been planned. He said, "I don't know whom it was meant to impress. It didn't impress me, and it didn't impress the jury." The verdicts came after a 5-month trial in which the government presented over 200 witnesses. The Trade Center bombing, which killed 6 people and injured more than 1,000, has been called the worst single act of terrorism ever committed on U.S. soil. Sentencing is set for May 4th. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell won't seek re-election. The decision is surprising. The Maine Democrat has bought time on Maine TV stations tonight to make his announcement. A statement released by his office says he wants to seek other challenges. He spent 14 years in the Senate. The Clinton administration is facing congressional criticism because it stopped military exercises with South Korea. That is part of an agreement to begin international inspection of North Korean nuclear sites. But America's top military official is defending the action. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
General John Shalikashvili, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told NPR that the suspension of Team Spirit, as the joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises are dubbed, was planned from the beginning if the North Koreans allowed inspections to begin and if negotiators for the North and South resumed talks.
The South Korean government announced that Team Spirit is suspended, and we've agreed with that decision. That means that we will continue to go ahead with the preparations for Team Spirit, nevertheless.
Preparations, the general says, for next year. Shalikashvili also says that the deployment of Patriot anti-missile batteries to South Korea has no urgency. He says the U.S. and South Korea do not want the deployment of the Patriots to be used as an excuse by the North to break off talks. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Authorities in Durango, Mexico, say actor John Candy died of a heart attack today. A city spokeswoman says Candy died in his sleep on the set of the movie he was filming. The Canadian native was 43. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up almost 14 points at 3,838. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The space shuttle Columbia is in orbit. 5 astronauts have begun a 2-week mission to conduct engineering and technology experiments. They range from semiconductor production to the melting of metal. The shuttle launch was delayed for a day after NASA managers decided yesterday's weather wasn't good enough to attempt a liftoff. The Columbia is to return to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on March 18th. Senator John Glenn says he's waiting for reports on current radiation testing. The Ohio Democrat is one of the chief critics of the government's handling of radiation experiments during the Cold War. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
Senator Glenn says Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary has told him there are more than 200 radiation experiments still underway that involve human testing. Glenn says the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee has given O'Leary until March 15th to provide more details on this current testing.
First, let's find out what happened in the past, what's going on right now, Then I was thinking about what about non-radiation experiments? If in radiation we were doing these things to our people on a grand scale, what are we doing with regard to chemicals and medicines and things that other researchers, government or otherwise, may be concerned about?
Glenn says he's encouraged by the president's directive requiring that any experiments on humans be shut down if the subjects haven't been informed of the risks involved. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
Police in Beaverton, Oregon, are investigating last night's assault on figure skater Tanya Harding. A spokesman says Harding says a man attacked her from behind as she was walking to her apartment. He knocked her to the ground and jumped on her back. She set off a personal alarm and the man fled. Police are looking into the possibility this was more than a random attack. Harding sustained a sprained wrist and bruises. The government reports the nation's unemployment rate fell 0.2% last month to 6.5%. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the woman Newsweek described as the most exciting individual in American theater. In her series of theater pieces, Anna Deavere Smith has been telling the complicated story of race in America. In her previous play, Fires in the Mirror, which was broadcast last year on public television, she took on the story of African Americans and Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn's Crown Heights. Now she's telling us the story of Los Angeles after the riots. Her piece, Twilight, is based on interviews with African Americans, whites, Latinos, and Koreans. Twilight is a series of monologues in which Smith, who is African American, portrays some of the people she interviewed. Her monologues are taken verbatim from the interviews. Some of the people she portrays are Rodney King's aunt, Daryl Gates, Reginald Denny, a Hollywood agent, and a Korean woman whose store was looted. Next week, she brings this piece to the Public Theater in New York for a month-long run. I spoke with her last summer, just after she premiered Twilight in Los Angeles. Before we talked, she performed an excerpt of the show.
This first character that I'm going to do is Mrs. Han, who is a Korean-American woman whose liquor store was burned down during the unrest in Los Angeles. Until last year, I thought America was the best. I still do. I don't deny that just because I am victim. But at the end of 92, when we were in such turmoil and we had so many financial problems and so many mental problems, I began to see that Koreans are completely left out of this society and we are nothing. Why? Is it because we are Korean? Is it because we have no politicians? Is it because we don't speak good English? Why? Why do we have to be left out? We don't qualify for medical treatment? No food stamp? No GR? No welfare? Anything? Many African Americans who never work get minimum amount of money to survive. We don't get any because we have a car and a house. And we are high taxpayers. Where do I find justice? Okay. Many African Americans probably think they won by the verdict. Many say only half, right? Justice was done. And I was sitting here watching them on television in the morning and all the day. And they were having a party. And they celebrated. All South Central, all the churches. And they said, well, finally, justice has been done in this society. But what about victims' rights? They destroyed many innocent Korean merchants to get their rights. Okay, they have a lot of respect, as I do, for Dr. Martin King. He is the only model of black community. I don't care, just Jackson. He is the model of nonviolence, and they would all like to be in his spirit. Then what about last year? They destroyed innocent people. And I wonder if that is really justice for them to get their rights in this way. I was swallowing the bitterness, sitting here alone and watching them. They were having so hilarious. But I was happy for them. And I was glad for them. At least they got something back. Okay, let's just forget about Korean victims or other victims who were destroyed by them. They fought for their rights for 2 centuries. And if they hadn't sacrificed, other minorities, Hispanic, Asian, would suffer more in the mainstream. That's why I understand and why I would like to be part of their enjoyment. I wish that black people and Korean people could live together. But after the riots, it's too much differences. That's why I have a mixed feeling about the verdict. The fire is still there. How do you call it? Igniting fire? It could burst out any time. And I call that piece Swallowing the Bitterness.
And I thank you so much for performing that excerpt. How did you find the woman whose voice you just did for us?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had 2 wonderful assistants from UCLA, 2 Korean-American women who are both graduate students at UCLA, and they went with me, which was very helpful. You know, it was very helpful to have with me Korean-speaking people, and also, you know, I think just culturally, I learned that I couldn't walk as brazenly into all communities the way that I had been able to walk by myself in Crown Heights.
Why couldn't you?
It's much more complicated. It's just the racial terrain here in Los Angeles is much more complex, as we can see from her piece. I mean, I think that the question that's so interesting here is, you know, is that really justice that they got their rights in this way? And there's a degree on the other side to which many African Americans, who do not feel that justice has been done, you know, that this is a Band-Aid, really. And many people who question whether justice can be done only in the courts, right? That, as Jesse Jackson said to me when I interviewed him, we have quiet, but we don't have justice. So it's a resounding and very haunting question, I find, throughout my exploration of what happened is in Los Angeles is what is justice and how do we find justice? But her question is it justice that they got their rights by burning things? Is a interesting question. And in fact, it's a very complicated piece to even do in Los Angeles because sometimes when I begin, Mrs. Han, there's a lot of laughter.
Why is there laughter?
I don't know. And not that I can identify laughter by race, by any means, but I think sometimes that laughter is coming from African Americans. When we had a group of young people, I believe it was young African Americans were laughing. They could be laughing at the way she talks, but there's also an intellectual response to her saying, we don't get any welfare because we have a car and a house and we are high taxpayers. People frequently laugh there. And it's a kind of like, ha ha, like a disbelief. And I think this shows us how complicated racial dynamics are, especially in these economic times. It's not us versus them. The us's and the them's are more varied than black and white, for one thing. And I think it's hard for people to put together who's us and who's them. But what we're finding out is us and them isn't a satisfactory way of looking at it, period.
My guest is Anna Deavere Smith. We're talking about her one-person show, Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anna Deavere Smith. We're talking about her show Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. And in this show, she becomes many of the people who were caught up in the aftermath of the Rodney King verdict, including Rodney King's aunt, Reginald Denny, a Korean woman whose liquor store was looted. She plays Daryl Gates. She plays people from just all the different sides and all the different parts of the story. One of the things I find amazing about your work is this. Usually when you're an actor, you have to find and believe in the truth of the one character that you're playing. And even if that character is a villain, no matter how evil that character is, you have to find their truth and see the world through their eyes. What you do in your work is you don't just empathize with one character, whether that character is good or bad. You empathize with everybody. You put yourself into the body, into the thoughts and mind of each of the people that you do. And in a piece like Twilight, you're putting yourself into the mind of everybody from Daryl Gates to Reginald Denny to, you know, a Korean woman whose shop was looted to somebody who was empathizing with the looters. You know, you're everybody. And I'm wondering if it was hard for you to empathize that much in such a complicated crisis.
Well, it certainly was more complicated than Fires in the Mirror. The other thing is that, you see, with Fires in the Mirror, not just me, but the whole audience has at its fingertips and in its heart this incredible emotional resource about the Holocaust and about slavery. Even if people aren't black or Jewish, we have had enough exposure to it in culture to have emotional reactions to it. And once again, not that many of us, and certainly I did not know what many of the Korean Americans have come from who've come to this country. I mean, they themselves have come from slavery. They've come from a history of colonialism. It's a country, I mean, it's remarkable, as I was told by one of the people that I interviewed, that they even have a language anymore. And so I think empathy is a tricky word. I really want to look and see what the root of it is, because I'm not so sure what I do is empathy, the way the common walking man thinks that empathy, I suppose, is kind of feeling for another person. Because I'm an actress, I have been trained in ways to identify. And sometimes that identification is really a sensory identification that, you know, I might grab on to something that a police officer does. Maybe it's the way Daryl Gates sits that attracts me, that allows me to get a hold of an aspect of him. It's not just coming from the heart and the mind, if I'm clear, Terry.
Mm-hmm. What was it that you feel you got from Daryl Gates?
You mean when I interviewed him?
When you interviewed him, and what is it that you want to put across to us when you're on stage?
Well, it's changing in performance.
Mm-hmm.
What I was working on was, he says, what I choose to do, what I've chosen to do in the piece is a part of his interview where he talks about how he has suddenly become, he says, suddenly, I am suddenly the symbol of police oppression in the United States, if not the world. Me. I am me. And he says that he asks the young people who consider him this symbol of oppression, and I ask him, where did you get that idea? I mean, who told you that? You don't know me. You never talked to me. 43 years in law enforcement, nobody's ever said that about me. No one. And suddenly, I am the symbol of police oppression. It's a tough thing to deal with. Well, for a long time, I was connecting to his, his shock, you know, in the use of the word sudden. But what I'm beginning to remember is the amount of charm that he had throughout the interview. And so, at least in my last performance, what I'm performing is a much less desperate, much more easygoing guy who even sees the humor in this suddenness.
I thought you were connecting, too, to a certain amount of self-delusion, the sense of, like, who, me? Suddenly they see me as being... when the L.A. Police Department had such a bad reputation for so long.
Yeah, but... okay, but that would be a dangerous place for me to go. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, tell me why.
Well, because that's what we would call, in traditional sense, judgment.
Right.
And that would keep me from getting to whatever is real. That kind of judgment would keep me from getting to what is real.
Now, did you talk to
any... Every human being has a level of reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so my job is to tease through all of the exteriors to find that. And, you know, on the other side, people who we may automatically take on as our heroes, right? It's even those people is to tease through all of that, you know, all of that that we worship to find what's real is what my job has to be.
Well, that leads to something I was going to ask you, which is what do you think it is that is different from watching you become these people than it is watching them be themselves? Well, you know, I always ask myself when I see you perform, why is it different watching you be them? Why do I get a layer of meaning watching you do them that I wouldn't get from just watching them?
I think we are all doing that when we meet people. We are constructing a reality of that person. It's just that in art, we abstract that reality, and it seems to be have a greater level of meaning because there's a more obvious convergence of that person's meaning and my level of meaning on them. But what I think that I have in common with the people that I'm interviewing or what I try to reenact is the process of them coming into their own authorship. So what I try to do in performance is to allow not just the words to come through or the feeling to come through, but the actual activity of coming up with the words to come through. And, you know, the more I perform, the more I work on trying to get the process of that available to the audience so that they can watch the train of thought that I watch when I'm watching a person talk to me. But I must say in Los Angeles, this was a kind of also a fascinating process because nobody in this town said what I expected them to say. Everybody shocked me. And ultimately, I began to talk about the twists and turns and the unexpected that I found in everyone's speech. And also the inability to speak, the inability to complete sentences was very obvious here. And I think that's because people, number one, don't fully know what to make of this. And number two, it's encouraging that I think people are willing to give up, you know, old ways of thinking and actually try to make up something in front of a stranger, which is what they were doing in front of me.
Well, who are some of the people who shocked you and what shocked you about what they said? Surprised you, I should say.
Reginald Denny stunned the living daylights out of me. Mm-hmm. I would never have expected him. And I still can't make a full sense for you of what is stunning about it, except that I think he has a message for the country at large. I'd be happy to do part of,
would you please?
Of Reginald for you, and then we'll see what you think, and we could talk about it a little bit.
Great.
This will be a little rough because I'm not going to take it from the beginning, but I'm going into the middle of it. And I asked him what happened, you know, when he got beat up, and we're going to come into the middle of it. At this point, he's talking about when he first realized something was wrong out there on Florence and Normandy. And I guess you talk about your heart skips a beat. When I realized something was wrong was when they bashed in the right window of my truck. And that's the end of what I remember for 5 or 6 days when I woke up in Daniel Freeman Hospital. And they say I was in a coma, and I was just trying to figure out how did I get here. And they didn't tell me there was a riot or anything. And I guess that was something the doctors didn't think I really needed to know. And I was on morphine for pain, so it was a really interesting time. And I've never been in an operating room before. And I mean, it's just like a scene from a movie. You know how they flip those big lights on? They're really in there. And so I was just thinking, God, and the doctors with masks on and stuff. And I guess when it started to dawn on me that something big must have happened was when really important people wanted to come by and say hi. And one of the first persons I was aware of who came to see me was Reverend Jesse Jackson. And I thought, not this guy. I mean, he has better things to do than to be hanging out at Daniel Freeman Hospital. That's the dude I seen on TV all the time. And then Arsenio Hall came to see me, and that's when I started to get it. And they still wouldn't let me watch it on TV, though. They really controlled that remote control thing. They just kept it on the movie channel. And I guess if it hadn't have been for me seeing some of the stuff, that was my one blessing, is I didn't remember a thing. If I didn't see some of the stuff, like climbing back into the truck or the things that Titus and Terry and Bobby and Lee, those are the guys that came to my rescue, stuff they were telling me, I never would have known. And Terry, she came to the hospital as a kind of a surprise guest visit, and that was a really interesting and emotional time. I mean, how do you say that someone saved my life? I mean, how can a person, how can I express enough thanks for them actually risking their neck for me? And I was kind of afraid isn't the word, but awkward, meeting the people who saved me, and finally I did. And it wasn't like meeting a stranger, it was like meeting a buddy. We all had this weird common thread in our lives. I mean, this was an extraordinary event. The guys up in the helicopter, they stuck with it, and then the four guys who seen it on TV and ran out and came to my rescue, and they told me I drove the truck for about 100 feet, but I was totally unconscious of everything I was seeing or doing. Because, well, I've been driving semis for 17 years now since I got out of high school, and it doesn't take much brains to do it. I guess it's kind of second nature. But Bobby, he tells me that he saw that that I was getting nowhere fast, so he just said enough's enough and jumped in and scooted me over, and by then it was a pretty bloody mess. I mean, I seen pictures of myself when I went into surgery, and it was just blood and glass, and they cut off my hair and showed it to me in a plastic bag, and it was just long hair and glass and blood. And Lee Ewell, I mean, that's a woman. And she tells me that she just kind of cradled me. And there's not a passenger seat in the truck, so I was down in the middle of the floor on my knees. And Lee's just covered in blood. And Titus, he's on the side because the windshield was so broken that Bobby couldn't see to drive. So Titus was on the running board telling Bobby where to drive. And Terry, Titus's girlfriend, she was out in front of the truck weaving through traffic, dodging towards cars, telling him to clear the path. And the next stop, Daniel Freeman Hospital. And Terry, in that piece, I think, is a very unexpected humanity. Number one, I think a lot of people didn't expect Reginald Denny to be as empty of blame as he seems to be. Mm-hmm. But moreover, it is a kind of a symbol for me about where we are right now in the country in terms of race relations and where we have to go. And as I rehearsed, particularly the section where he says there's a weird common thread in our lives, I began to think of our journey to find a way of living together in our differences as a kind of a coming into consciousness, which is not unlike his coming into consciousness in that hospital. I don't think we're still in full consciousness. And to get to full consciousness, we're going to have to wake up to the fact that we have been in a tragedy, which is as graphic as his tragedy of waking up with his jaw sewn together and, you know, major brain surgery and everything else. And that tragedy is racism. And it's taking a long time for us to come into consciousness because it's a painful coming into consciousness. And we've used many different kinds of drugs, morphine, metaphorically speaking, and everything else to make it easy for ourselves. But there's no easy coming.
Anna Deavere Smith will perform Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992, at the Public Theater in Manhattan from March 8th through April 3rd. Our interview was recorded last July after the premiere of the show in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There's a new restoration print of Midnight Cowboy in celebration of the film's 25th anniversary. When it was first released, it got an X rating, but it won Academy Awards for Best Picture and Best Director. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the film's director, John Schlesinger. He also directed Marathon Man and The Falcon and the Snowman. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, starring Jim Carrey of In Living Color. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. It's been an emotional day of testimony as the defense presents its case in the Pensacola, Florida murder trial of Michael Griffith. He's the anti-abortionist accused of killing Dr. David Gunn behind a women's clinic last March. Debbie Elliott reports.
32-year-old Michael Griffin broke down into tears today as a local anti-abortion activist testified that he showed Griffin an effigy portraying Dr. David Gunn.
It was a doctor that had rubber gloves on, and I guess it was about maybe 5 feet tall. On the gloves, I think maybe the gloves had red paint splattered on.
John Burt denies encouraging Griffin to kill Dr. Gunn.
You'd like to see the arms and legs of Dr. David Gunn pulled off like these aborted fetuses.
Oh, that's a lie.
The defense also called David Gunn's girlfriend today, who emotionally testified that John Burt had harassed her family and Dr. Gunn. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Pensacola, Florida.
The White House is denying a published report that the president's senior counsel is thinking about resigning. The Washington Post says Bernard Nussbaum may quit because of the uproar over meetings he held with investigators over the Clintons' Whitewater land deal. A White House spokeswoman says the report was news to Nussbaum and that he has the support of Mr. Clinton. But the Associated Press is quoting another White House official who says it is likely Nussbaum will depart soon. It was an on-time liftoff for the space shuttle Columbia today. The shuttle and its crew are on a 2-week research mission. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
NASA's oldest shuttle is now orbiting the Earth some 160 nautical miles high, where astronauts will take advantage of the microgravity environment to conduct many of their onboard experiments. Most of the work during this long-duration flight will be dedicated to technology for Earth applications, such as finding better ways to develop semiconductor materials and engineer new drug treatments for humans and animals. Research will also look at better ways to construct satellites. Astronauts will also test a new magnetic fixture on the shuttle's 50-foot robot arm. The new design may increase the arm's dexterity and provide for a better feel when it grapples satellites or other shuttle payloads. The crew will also conduct biomedical research on themselves to learn more about how humans adapt to longer periods of spaceflight. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
The government says its economic forecast is good. The index of leading economic indicators rose 0.3% in January. The index has gone up for the last 6 months. It's intended to predict the nation's economic activity 6 to 9 months in advance. On Wall Street, stock prices closed up almost 8 points today to end at 3,832.30. Advancing issues led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. 3 Palestinians have died today in Israel. The army says the first died while participating in a knife attack on Jewish settlers in Gaza. Arab sources say a second was shot to death by Israeli soldiers in a clash in the West Bank. A third was reportedly killed in Gaza City when he stabbed a soldier outside a mosque. Jerusalem police say they have restricted access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque today. They've also prevented Jews for a brief time from going to the Wailing Wall. A Jewish settler shot at least 39 Muslim worshippers to death a week ago in a West Bank mosque. The Zulu nationalist Inkatha Freedom Party has decided to register for South Africa's first all-race election in April. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Inkatha leaders say their registration is only provisional. A final decision on whether the party will actually campaign in the elections now depends on whether international mediators can resolve Inkatha's demands for greater Zulu autonomy. The rival African National Congress this week agreed to seek mediation, but few politicians believe that international negotiations can be set up and completed before the elections in late April. Nevertheless, Inkatha's decision to register eases some of the campaign tensions in Natal province, where Inkatha partisans and the ANC Zulu supporters have fought each other for 9 years. The ANC also hopes that Inkatha's action might persuade some of its conservative allies to conditionally register for the balloting. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
President Clinton says the United States is ready to double financial aid to Ukraine to help stabilize the former Soviet republic. Mr. Clinton says this is a response to that country's moves toward economic reform and nuclear disarmament. The president and Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk have concluded formal meetings at the White House. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The film Midnight Cowboy has been re-released in honor of its 25th anniversary. It opened in New York and Los Angeles and will open in other cities later this month. When the film first opened in 1969, it was given an X rating, but it won Academy Awards for Best Film, Best Screenplay, and Best Director. We're going to hear an interview with the director, John Schlesinger, recorded in 1988. Schlesinger's other movies include Billy Liar, Sunday Bloody Sunday, Marathon Man, The Falcon and the Snowman, and The Believers. Schlesinger is English. Midnight Cowboy was the first film that he made in the United States. The film stars John Voight as a Texan who's just come to Manhattan, where he plans to become a great stud. But instead of hustling other people, everyone else hustles him. One of the odd characters he meets is Ratso Rizzo, played by Dustin Hoffman. This is the scene where the two meet in a bar. John Voight is being propositioned by a transvestite.
Hi, cowboy. Got a cigarette?
Hey, sweetheart.
More damn faggots in this town.
Oh, kiss it, Ratso.
Up yours. You gotta watch out for that.
Hey, you really know the ropes.
Oh, damn, I wish I bumped into you before.
Huh.
I'm Joe Buck from Texas.
Enrico Rizzo, from the Bronx.
And I'm gonna buy you a drink. What the hell do you think of that?
Well, I don't mind if I do.
Bartender, drinks all around. One for my friend here, too.
Damn, I know when I give satisfaction, I give her satisfaction. I mean, you see what I'm getting at here? She got a penthouse up there with a color TV, more diamonds than an archbishop. And she busts out bowling when I ask her for money.
For what?
For money.
Wait a minute. For money for what?
Oh, hell, I'm a hustler. You didn't know that?
Now, how am I supposed to know that? I mean, you got to tell a person these things.
I'm a hustler.
It's a scene from Midnight Cowboy. Now, this is the story of someone who comes from Texas to New York and really doesn't know his way around and makes a lot of mistakes while learning the ropes. This was your first film in America. Did you empathize at all since you were new to the country yourself?
Totally. I mean, that was the reason I thought I could make the film, because in a sense, New York is a fantasy for the cowboy. And he thinks, he imagines it as one thing, and then the reality turns out to be something quite different. And I suppose in a way I could sympathise and empathise with that. And most of the films that I've made in the States have in some way been about fantasy or fantasists. And I felt that that was something I really could relate to.
You worked with Dustin Hoffman in this film. Before he really became a star, I think you actually cast him before The Graduate came out.
No, The Graduate was already out, and I didn't believe that he was a character actor until I actually met him. dressed for the role, he came to meet me in New York, and we walked around 42nd Street, and he wearing a dirty old raincoat, and kind of melded in so perfectly with the background that he got the part by the end of the evening. And all I'd got to go on was the reputation as a character actor and having seen him in The Graduate playing a very different kind of role.
When he was walking around in that raincoat, was that something he was doing to prove to you how good a character actor he could be, or is that just the way he was dressed?
No, he was trying to prove.
Oh, okay,
he was trying to
checking.
Get the part, I reckon, yes.
I think when this movie came out, it was X-rated.
Yes.
Initially?
Yes, it was.
It seems pretty tame by today's standards. I mean, there's four-letter words in it and some nudity, but it's still... You think it would have gotten an X today?
No. It very quickly lost its X, in fact.
Oh.
After the Oscars.
Did you fight for that, or did you just...
No, at the time, I think Jerry Hellman, the producer, and I both felt, you know, okay, if that's probably what it should get. It was the X rating then meant something quite different to the rating now. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it got an R rating, they'd already changed the meanings of what X rating represented.
Midnight Cowboy was your first film in the United States. Why did you want to make an American film?
Oh, I thought the book was extraordinary, and it would give me an opportunity to deal with an American theme. I hadn't Until I read the book, I'd had no ambition actually to come here to work. And when I read it, I thought, this is a hell of a story, and I understand these two characters, even though I don't know them, really. And I came to America on the heels of a tremendous failure, Far From the Madding Crowd, which was a quite tough baptism of fire. And I stayed on in Los Angeles after it had opened there and flopped rather badly, working on the screenplay of Midnight Cowboy with Waldo Salt, and hung around, you know, Hollywood Boulevard, which is a fairly sleazy area, and some of the things in the film I saw and experienced on the boulevard, and then came to New York, and with Waldo we trudged the streets of New York experiencing more things, all of which have a place in the movie. And it was a very interesting period of my life because I came to the States to promote a film which hadn't worked. So I knew what rejection in Hollywood terms meant and how. And then started to work on this next movie and really got more and more hooked and intrigued by the whole subject.
Well, Midnight Cowboy was made in 1969. Let me ask you about a film you made a couple of years later in England, Sunday Bloody Sunday.
And yes.
This film starred Glenda Jackson and Peter Finch as two people both in love with the same man, a bisexual man. Was it hard to get backing to do this movie? It was not a moralistic film that preached against homosexuality.
No, it certainly wasn't. No, it was, and funnily enough, though the subject was tough, I suppose, the fact that Midnight Cowboy was so successful enabled me to get backing fairly quickly from United Artists, who'd also distributed Midnight Cowboy. And I remember the remark of David Picker, who was running the company, head of production at that time. I don't quite know where this script is taking us, but if you want to do it, do it. It's not going to cost too much. And we did.
There's a scene where Peter Finch and Murray Head, the actor who plays the bisexual man, kiss. And it was really a very brave scene for the time, for 1971.
Yes, that was ahead of its time.
Did you have to fight to include that?
No, I didn't have to fight to include it. I mean, some very strange things happened. I mean, the actors didn't object to doing it because they realised that it was quite important. And I felt it had to be treated just as an everyday occurrence. I mean, Penelope Gilliatt, who wrote the screenplay, and I had some quite serious arguments about the scene because she felt it should be kind of done in long shot and silhouette and in a sense made a special deal of by trying to throw it away. And I felt it should just happen in front of the camera with no big deal as part of their everyday behaviour in private. And that's the way we did it. And there were objections, certainly, in the cinema. I remember one of the first screenings in America, a woman nudged her husband in front of me and said, "Come on, Harry, let's get out. This is not a film for nice people." And Peter Finch's wife could never quite get used to it when she came to the opening at Venice Festival. I remember she screamed out loud when the kiss happened. And I said before the London premiere, now, please just keep your trap shut. You know it's coming. Shut up. But she couldn't resist screaming again. So I was very glad when she wasn't on the road with us in America.
It's really funny. She'd probably seen her husband getting killed in movies.
Yes, but, no. But the
didn't
idea,
get this kind of reaction.
No, this was more horrendous to her, I guess. Anyway, it was a film that I think was probably ahead of its time. And I don't think the United Artists expected it to have the kind of critical success it did.
My guest is film director John Schlesinger. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with film director John Schlesinger.
Let me ask you about the film Marathon Man. You made this in 1976. It also starred Dustin Hoffman. As a graduate student who unwittingly becomes involved in international espionage, now the most talked about scene in this movie is the dental torture scene in which Dustin Hoffman is tortured by Laurence Olivier. Olivier plays a Nazi doctor who uses his dentistry as a technique to extract information from people under torture. I want to just play this scene and then talk with you about making it. So this is Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, please don't worry. I'm not going into that cavity. That nerve's already dying. A live, freshly cut nerve is infinitely more sensitive.
So I'll just drill into a healthy tooth until I reach the pulp. Unless, of course, you can tell me that it's safe.
Their heart! He knew nothing. If he'd known, he would have told. Get rid of him.
Not very pretty, is it?
It's worse on sound than it is in vision, in fact.
No, it's more like the real thing where you have your eyes clenched shut and you're just hearing the sounds of the drill.
Yes, you never ever see it in the film. You never see drill on tooth. It's all suggested by eyes and by the drill coming towards the camera.
Well, civilians never really do see what that looks like. Only dentists get to see that.
No, but I mean, the audience never see it.
But I mean, it's more like the way you experience
it. Yes, absolutely.
Because you don't see the drill hitting your teeth when you're in the dentist's office.
No, but you see it coming towards your
mouth.
And that scene, I mean, had everybody squirming. It was in the book, Bill Gilman's book, and I thought it was a terrific scene. But we had to do it very artfully. Though I knew that it was literally a nerve that would hit, when hit, would affect everyone, certainly me. Because I think very often you put things into films which affect you one way and another, certainly things that terrify you, and the dentist, going to the dentist always terrified me. So it was a scene that I felt very, very strongly identification with.
Did you want to make the scene as horrible as possible, or did you want to keep it medium horrible?
I wanted to make it feel, but I didn't want it to be gloating over the violence of it, which is why we never showed anything graphic. It was all suggested. And the first moment that you hear the whir of the motor of the drill, you don't even see it. It's behind the lid of a suitcase, which is opened. I always think that everything is better suggested and leave the rest to the audience imagination, where possible.
It wouldn't surprise me if there was more than once when you were in the dentist chair and your dentist before undoing the drill gave you his impressions or her impressions of the scene. Has that happened to you?
Well, I must confess that since the film, I've been probably more scared of going to the dentist for fear that they'd get revenge. But I know my dentist quite well. And funnily enough, dentists that I've been to have always rather enjoyed the film. So they haven't tortured me too badly.
Well, good. You entered the film industry in England right after the Second World War. What kind of state was the movie industry in when you...
Well, I tried to get into it after the Second World War. I made when I was a student, amateur student film about a hanging in the 17th century that had actually taken place on a hill near where my family lived. And it got some attention. It was just a student film. Then I became a professional actor, so I didn't go into the film industry immediately because, as usual, there was a slump, as there always seemed to be permanently slumps in different countries' film industry, and there certainly is often in England. And I tried, of having made this student film, to get a job as a tea boy or an assistant, and couldn't. So I became a professional actor for some years, made a small documentary about Hyde Park, which got shown by BBC Television, and eventually got in through television, making small documentaries for magazine programmes. And that got me my break, finally.
What about working with actors? Do you have a certain style in working with them? Do you like to let them bring what they want to a performance, or do you try to pretty strictly guide what they do?
Well, I have very strong visual images of what I want to do with the film before I start shooting. And within those parameters, I feel that the actors must be given freedom to express themselves as much as they can. I mean, I think they've got a great deal to add to a film. If I respect the actors, there are some actors that are very selfish and need hitting hard, and some that are very inexperienced and frightened and need help. But the majority of them, I've found, are people that you're collaborating with in a spirit of very sort of warm creation, in a sense. You've got to give them space to feel free, to make fools of themselves if necessary, and then you are there to hold them down and to tell them where to taper down a performance. Because acting for the movies isn't really acting, it's being a character. And as long as I feel I'm trusted and I trust them, then I think there's an extremely fruitful atmosphere for collaboration.
Do you think that having acted before you started directing has made you more sensitive to the actors that you work with?
I think I know what their problems are when they come on the set and everybody's hanging around and there's pressure, which there always is, to get a performance as quickly as possible. And I admire good screen acting tremendously. I mean, there are certain favourite actors I have who, like Peter Finch had and Alan Bates has, which is the quality of conceal, there's more there, and it doesn't all show itself at once. Some actors, you see the performance, and they can be very good actors and very good performances, but you don't feel there's a reserve, greater emotional reserve underneath, which the best screen actors, I think, have. Monty Clift had it in spades.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your directing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
John Schlesinger recorded in 1988. His 1969 film Midnight Cowboy has been re-released. It's opened in New York and L.A. It opens in other cities later this month. This is Fresh Air. There's been a conviction in the World Trade Center bombing. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Jim Zeroli reports from New York City on that case. Four Muslim fundamentalists convicted, charges of conspiracy and assault. The sentence will be given out on the 4th of May. They could be in prison for life. Lynn Neary reports from Baltimore on perceptions within the African-American community of the controversial message of the Nation of Islam. Also, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell of Maine says he's not going to run for re-election. No reason was given. And I'll talk with a young man in California, 17 years old. He is changing his name to Trout Fishing in America. That's the name of a Richard Brautigan novel.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Up until now, Jim Carrey has been known as the wacko white guy on Fox TV's In Living Color.
But his new movie, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, has suddenly made him a superstar. It's been the number one movie in the country 3 out of the last 4 weeks. And last week, Jim Carrey's price soared from $1 million a picture to $7 million. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to find out why.
You know what morphing is, right? That's the liquidy effect that allowed the villain to metamorphose in Terminator 2, and that Michael Jackson used to make the faces transform in his black and white video. It's a great computer innovation. Jim Carrey can do it with his mouth. He can also do a slow-motion instant replay without the aid of video equipment, and he can throw himself into reverse, too. He can turn into Wile E. Coyote 1 minute, the clairvoyant dwarf from Poltergeist the next, and then do the entire cast of Star Trek. He's a living, breathing special effect. In repose, Jim Carrey would be strikingly good-looking, tall and slender, with piercing eyes, copious dimples, and teeth so big and white that he makes Nancy Kerrigan look like Gabby Hayes. But he's never in repose. Carrey can't do anything without giving it a spin. And not a little spin. He puts enough English on his lines to send them into orbit. In Ace Ventura, he plays a pet detective, which turns out to be somebody who tracks down lost and stolen dogs, cats, and in this case, dolphins. The mascot of the Miami Dolphins, to be exact. Needless to say, the cops don't take this goon very seriously. In fact, the police lieutenant, Lois, played by campy Sean Young, has a suggestion for Mr. Ventura.
May I suggest you yield to the experts on this one? We'll find the porpoise.
Whew. Now I feel better. Of course, that might not do any good. You see, nobody's missing a porpoise. It's a dolphin that's been taken. The common harbor porpoise has an abrupt snout, pointed teeth, and a triangular thoracic fin, while the bottlenose dolphin, or Terciops truncatus, has an elongated beak, round cone-shaped teeth, and a serrated dorsal appendage. I'm sure you already knew that. That's what turns me on about you. Your attention to detail.
Listen, pet dick. How would you like me to make your life a living hell?
Well, I'm not really ready for a relationship, Lois, but thank you for asking.
Ace Ventura isn't a very good movie. The plot seems to be on its last legs almost before it gets started, and the director, Tom Shadyac, has a rudimentary sitcom style. But then, maybe that's all he needs. With Carrey on the screen, any scene is already way too busy. He's in a constant state of extreme parody. Sometimes you may not know exactly what he's parodying, but his simpering insincerity is unmistakable. In fact, it occurred to me that Ace Ventura, Pet Detective is the Generation X movie that Reality Bites, for instance, is trying to be. Here are all the tacky TV and movie and brand name references, delivered with an attitude that can only be called wide-eyed cynicism. On Planet Carrey, nothing has any meaning or any value, but that's no reason not to have a good laugh about it. So, who is this guy? Is he Jerry Lewis, only with sex appeal? Or does he have the potential to become a major comic actor like Steve Martin? At the moment, it looks as though Jim Carrey can do anything. What he can't do, and what he needs to learn how to do, if only for a few minutes at a time, is nothing at all.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After editing the letters of his father, John Cheever, Ben Cheever started publishing his own novels. His new book, The Partisan, is a humorous novel about a writer, his memoir, and his family secrets. Ben Cheever will talk with us about it on the next Fresh Air. I hope you'll join us.